I loved the emotional rush of being scared. I still do, of course. I don't go out much to haunted houses, but I still love good, old-fashioned, scary stories.
Listener discretion is advised.
On September 17, 1966, Diane Keidel was 31 years old and lived in Phoenix, Arizona with her four children. She was divorcing her second husband, Lyle Eugene Keidel, who went by the name Gene. Diane was born Diane Kidder in April 1935 in Peoria, Illinois. In 1956, when Diane was 21, she was living in Peoria. She was recently divorced and she had a 2-year-old daughter, Susie. To make some money, Diane worked at her father's grocery store. That's where she met the man who would become her second husband, Gene. They got married that year. They eventually relocated to Phoenix, Arizona. Gene got a job as a machinist. He later became a self-employed house contractor. The couple had 3 children of their own. Greg was born in 1957, followed by Kelly in 1958. And Lori, 1961. Diane and Gene's marriage was marred by violence. Gene was also abusive to the kids. Diane and Gene both abused alcohol. They both had extramarital affairs. Diane even had affairs with some of Gene's co-workers. Gene supposedly overheard co-workers talking about Diane. They said she was pregnant and had an abortion. This was after Gene had a vasectomy. In July 1966, Diane filed for a divorce. Gene moved into an apartment with his father, about a mile from the family's home. On September 17, 1966, Gene and Lori took the kids to a fast food restaurant for dinner. Then Gene and Diane went to a bar and drank. They left the bar around 11:15 p.m. Diane drove Gene home. Diane then went to a bar to meet the man she had been seeing, Bob Marlin. Marlin was a former co-worker of Gene's. Around 1 a.m., Diane left the bar and drove home. The next day, Gene reported Diane missing. The police went to the family's home and found Diane's car parked in the carport. Her purse, identification, and keys were in the house. Gene explained that the night before he had called the house and talked to Susie. He found out that Diane wasn't home. He went to the house to relieve the babysitter. He said that he fell asleep around 3 a.m. He woke a couple of hours later at 5:30 a.m. and discovered Diane missing. The police talked to the last person who saw Diane, Bob Marlin. Marlin said that Diane left the bar at 1 a.m. He called her twice at home about an hour later, and no one answered. Marlin also had some interesting information about Gene. He said that Gene had been stalking Diane. A week earlier, Gene had taken photographs of him and Diane outside the family's home. Marlin said that he ran Gene off. The police never did a follow-up interview with Bob Marlin. He died of a heart attack the next day. At the time of her disappearance, Diane was working in an office. 2 days after she was reported missing, when Diane didn't show up for work, one of her co-workers called the police to report her missing. The investigators talked to the co-worker. She said that Diane was afraid of Gene. She also said that Gene had been stalking Diane. He'd watch her from an alley behind the house. The same day Diane went missing, Gene moved back into the family's home. Gene told everyone that Diane had run off with a boyfriend, but not many people believed him. People who knew Diane said she was a devoted mother who would never abandon her children. Also, if she was going to run away, why didn't she take her purse, clothes, or any other personal belongings? The detectives on the case believed that Gene was responsible for her disappearance. He had a history of abusing Diane. He was stalking her, and he did not have a strong alibi. He said that he did not see Diane on the morning she went missing. But the police knew that Diane had come home while he was there. The problem was that the police could not find any evidence that Jean made Diane disappear. The police talked to 12-year-old Susie, Diane's daughter from her first marriage. She said she went to sleep after her stepfather came over. She said she didn't see or hear anything unusual. They also interviewed Greg, who claimed that the family had no problems. So it wasn't long before the case went cold. Four months later, tragedy struck the family. Just before midnight on January 9, 1967, a fire broke out in the family's house. Neighbors saw the fire and one called the fire department. Several neighbors rushed to help. 9-year-old Greg was able to climb out of his bedroom window. Neighbors could hear the three girls screaming inside the house, but the fire was too intense to help them. The fire department arrived, and while wearing a breathing apparatus, firefighter Ray Mullins entered the house. He found 8-year-old Kelly in bed and handed her to another firefighter through a window. Mullins then found 12-year-old Susie, who was lying on top of 5-year-old Lori. He got them out of the house, laying them on the ground. Tragically, 12-year-old Susie and 8-year-old Kelly had both died. Lori had 3rd, 4th, and 5th degree burns on 50% of her body. 5th degree burns are the most serious type of burns, and bones can be charred. 5-year-old Lori was taken to the hospital, where she was in critical condition. Susie is credited with protecting Lori from the fire and ultimately saving her. Lori later said that as her sister laid on top of her, she kept saying, "I love you and I'll never leave you." Lori said that it was the purest love she had ever experienced. Jean was not at home when the fire started. He claimed he had been at a nearby laundromat drying some clothes. One thing that many people found odd was how he acted at the scene. He was standing among the crowd of onlookers. Neighbors had to point him out to the police on the scene. When Jean finally came forward, he seemed emotionless when he saw his stepdaughter and two daughters lying on the lawn with severe burns on their bodies. He also smelled of alcohol. He told a police officer he picked up a beer and drank it at the laundromat. But the officer said it smelled like he had a lot more than one beer. Days after the fire, it was declared that the fire was an accident. According to Jean, he put an aluminum pot on a burner for coffee the next morning, but he didn't realize that the burner was on. The investigators concluded that all the water boiled away and then the pot melted. This led to the pot exploding, which led to the curtains catching fire. In the 36 hours after the fire, Lori clung to life in the hospital. Her heart stopped twice. Many people at the hospital noted that Jean was rarely there. The first night, within hours of the fire, he had gone home with a woman he was dating. Jean got the insurance money and he rebuilt the house. After 85 days, Lori was taken out of the hospital and she went to live with Jean and her brother Greg. The fire confirmed for a lot of people that Diane was dead. They thought if she had just run away, the death of two of her children and Lori being in critical condition would have drawn her out. But no one heard from her. In 1969, the police reopened Diane's disappearance. But they did not come any closer to figuring out what happened to 31-year-old Diane Keidel. The case then went cold. Years went by. Then in June 1993, there was a major break in the case. On June 9, 1993, Jean and Diane's youngest daughter, 31-year-old Lori, walked into the Phoenix police station. Loria got married 10 years earlier, and her last name was Romanek. But she had divorced her husband after several years of marriage. Loria spoke with cold case investigator Ed Reynolds. She told him she knew what happened to her mother. Loria explained that the night her mother went missing, she had come home from the bar. Her mother and father got into an argument and it turned physical. Loria said that the fight drew her and her older sister, Susie, out of the bedroom. Her mother saw them and told them to go back to bed. While Diane was distracted, Jean hit her with an intense right hook. Their mother fell and hit her head on the door railing and then slumped to the floor. Susie and Loria then hid in a closet where they fell asleep. Loria said she woke a short time later and went looking for her mother. Loria heard her father digging in the backyard, so she stepped out the back door to investigate. Her mother's body was beside the pool. Loria thought that her mother was sleeping. She thought it was odd that her father was doing yard work in the middle of the night while her mother was sleeping in the yard near him. Loria said that Susie came and got her and brought her back inside. 3 days later, Jean borrowed a cement mixer from work and poured 6 inches of cement over the area where he had been digging. Jean told neighbors that it was the foundation for his shed, but he never constructed a shed. Loria said that Jean knew she had seen the assault and had seen him bury her mother in the backyard. But Loria was only 5 when her mother was killed, and she did not understand death. One time at a party, Jean saw her throwing pieces of bread in the corner of the backyard where her mother was buried. Loria explained to the detective that the family had a pet turtle, but it had gone missing after its cage was left open. Loria and her sister concluded it climbed into a hole under the sandbox to hibernate. Susie told her to leave some bread chunks near the hole for when the tortoise woke up because it might be hungry. So when Jean asked Loria what she was doing, she told him that she was leaving food for her mother in case she was hungry when she woke up. Jean told her to stop talking about her mother waking up. Then, 4 months after Diane went missing, there was the deadly fire that killed her 2 sisters and nearly killed her. Loria's 2 sisters were buried in an unmarked grave while she was still in the hospital, so she did not attend their funerals. About a year after the fire, Loria went to the funeral of a young man who had lived in the neighborhood. He had been killed in the Vietnam War. Loria screamed that someone needed to wake up the young man. But an older lady explained to her that the young man was dead and he would never wake up. Finally, Loria realized that her mother was dead. Loria explained to Detective Reynolds that the murder wasn't a repressed memory. She said she always remembered the fight and her father burying her mother in the backyard. After she moved out of that house, there were times when she returned to the home and asked the people living there if she could stand by the pool. She did that because she wanted to be close to her mother. Loria explained she waited 27 years to come forward because she was terrified of her father. He had mentally and physically abused her most of her life. Jean wasn't the only one to abuse her. When she was 11, her brother Greg and his friends started sexually abusing her. Sadly, they weren't the only ones to sexually abuse her. When she was 15, one of Jean's friends raped her and she became pregnant. She terminated the pregnancy. Loria told Detective Reynolds that she believed that the fire was not an accident. She thinks her father started the fire to kill her because she knew the location of her mother's body. Loria said that her father told her different stories about the fire's origin. Initially, he told her that he accidentally left a pan with water for coffee on a hot burner. But later, he blamed it on Susie, who had saved her by laying on top of her and shielding her from the flames. Her father told her that Susie was cooking on the stove and left the pot on a hot burner. Loria knew that this wasn't true because Susie was asleep at the time of the fire. She also said that after the fire, her father was still trying to silence her. For example, he took her out of the hospital early against the advice of doctors and hospital orders. Her skin was still healing. Lori went back to the house, which was still being rebuilt, and smelled of the fire that killed her two sisters and nearly killed her. Lori thought that her father did this to maintain control over her. She also said that her father would take her out on his boat on the San Diego Bay. He would throw her in the water and tell her to swim back to shore. Sometimes they were so far out that she couldn't see the shore. He then drove the boat back to the shore. Lori said that her skin was still healing from the burns, and as she swam, her skin opened and she bled. She said that this drew fish to her and they bit her. But she ultimately made it back to the shore every time. Lori said that her father was always surprised to see her. Lori later realized that this would have been an easy way to kill her and make it look like an accident. Lori said that this happened 8 to 10 times, and then she refused to go on the boat. Lori said that as the years passed, she pretended she didn't know what happened to her mother. Her father then stopped trying to kill her. When Lori was 18, she moved out and didn't tell her father where she went. Then one day, he suddenly showed up at her home. She was not sure how he found her. Randomly, he would make appearances in her life. Lori knew it was to keep her afraid so she wouldn't go to the police. But after 27 years, she finally had the courage to tell the police the truth. She also gave Detective Reynolds a written statement, which she signed in front of him. Lori believed that by telling the detective what happened to her mother, it would immediately lead to the backyard being dug up. But it was not that easy. Detective Reynolds did not doubt that Lori believed she was telling the truth. The problem was that it was a 27-year-old memory from when she was 5. It simply wasn't a reliable enough statement. Nevertheless, Detective Reynolds began to investigate. He learned that the initial investigators who worked on Diane's disappearance had asked their superiors in 1966 to break up the concrete and search the backyard. Their request was denied. Detective Reynolds thought this was promising, so he continued to investigate. He contacted Lori's brother, Greg. Greg did not know what happened to his mother. Greg ended up telling his father that Lori had gone to the police and told them she had witnessed him murder their mother and saw him bury her body in the backyard. Jean called Lori and told her to keep quiet or she'd be sorry. Lori then started sleeping with a gun under her pillow. Over a month after the meeting with Detective Reynolds, Lori Romanek had a reunion with the surviving firefighters who were there on the night of the fire. This included the man who saved her, Ray Mullins, who had since retired. Lori and Mullins continued to communicate after the reunion. She told him that she had gone to the police regarding her mother's disappearance and the fire. Mullins said he would help if he could. Lori and Mullins eventually started dating. Detective Reynolds tracked down Jean's second wife, whom he had since divorced. He had married her in 1969, 2 years after the deadly blaze. She told Detective Reynolds that Jean was a violent alcoholic. She heard rumors around the neighborhood that Diane was buried in the backyard. At the time, she did not believe it. But, with the benefit of hindsight, she thought it could be possible. She remembered while living in the house, she wanted to plant a rose bush in the backyard to hide the pool pump. Jean snapped and threatened to kill her. She also told Detective Reynolds that Jean was abusive to Lori. He remembered one incident when Lori came home late and Jean beat her. She had to stop Jean because he was getting excited as he beat her. After a series of bad investments, Jean was forced to sell the house in 1971. Jean's second wife said shortly after they sold the house, they returned to get a rollaway bed they had let the new owners borrow. When they arrived, Jean heard a jackhammer in the backyard and freaked out. He ran through the house and into the backyard and found the new owner chipping away at part of the concrete. The new homeowner explained he was putting in a hot tub. Gene told him not to put it in that location because there were pipes and wiring. He offered to help him install the hot tub in a different area. The new owner agreed, and Gene followed through with his offer to help. The area where the rose bush was going to be planted and the hot tub installed was where Lori said her mother was buried. Detective Reynolds also tracked down Kitty Andrews, the woman Gene was dating at the time of Diane's disappearance and the fire. Kitty said that she was at a low point in her life when she met Gene. She had been a devout Christian, but shortly before she started dating Gene, she experienced great hardship. She got divorced, was raped, and one of her children, a toddler, died from liver disease. This led to her drinking too much and hanging out at bars. She said that after Diane disappeared, Gene let her wear her clothes. Kitty was interviewed about the fire in 1967. At the time, she said she ate dinner with Gene and his kids, and then they went shopping at a local mall. They returned to the Kaidel home around 9 p.m. and stayed for about 30 minutes. Gene then drove her to her home. He went inside for about half an hour and then returned home. Gene was there while she was being interviewed, and he said that after he dropped her off, he went directly home. Around 11:40, he went to the laundromat. When Kitty was interviewed nearly three decades later, she said that wasn't what happened. She said they didn't go shopping, and Gene didn't drive her home. She said that day, she and her young son went to the Kaidel home and washed the family's clothes. But there was a problem. The dryer didn't work. Gene was furious that she left the clothes wet. She had never seen him so angry, so she got her son and drove herself home. Then, hours after the fire, while Lori was in critical condition in the hospital, Gene came to her home. Within 4 hours of the blaze that killed his daughter and stepdaughter, and his other daughter was in critical condition, they had sex. Kitty also said that Gene blamed the fire on Susie. He said she caused it by making popcorn on the stove. But Kitty didn't think the story made much sense. Detective Reynolds talked to other people about the fire, and Gene gave them different explanations for the cause. He told his only son Greg that a frying pan with grease and potatoes had been left on the burner, which was still on. It splattered grease around the stove, which led to the fire. Gene told a neighbor that Susie had put a pot of water on the stove. Gene thought she was going to boil some eggs, but she went to bed and forgot about the pot. Hours after the fire, Gene told the detective he must have accidentally turned the stove on while wiping it down. In September 1993, Detective Reynolds asked the fire department to reopen the case, and they agreed. According to the news journal, the Phoenix New Times, the police and the fire department didn't do several things that arson investigators are supposed to do. They did not interview the firefighters at the scene or the surviving children. They didn't even review the reports or study photographs of the scene. Nor was there an official examination of the burns on the bodies of Lori, Susie, and Kelly. They took samples of ash, but they should have taken floor samples from the area around the fire's origin and other parts of the house. Finally, while Gene was interviewed, he was never formally interrogated. Ray Mullins, who rescued Lori and dated her as an adult, was convinced there was a cover-up. He always thought that the blaze was intentionally set. He was in the house while it was engulfed in flames, and he said it was too hot to be a kitchen fire. He believed that an accelerant had been used. Detective Reynolds talked to the original arson investigator. He said that the case had always bothered him. He had seen photos of the burns on the bodies. If it had been an accidental kitchen fire, the fire would have spread through the ceiling and the children would have burns on their heads and upper bodies. But most of the burns were on lower parts of their bodies, meaning the fire was on the floor. Also, the fire spread very quickly. It was too fast for it to be an accidental kitchen fire. Finally, the fire's origins, known as a hotspot, was found about 10 feet from the stove. There were two other hot spots found in the house. This was all evidence that an accelerant had been poured on the floor throughout the house. Although the investigator was suspicious, he was ordered to wrap up the investigation quickly, so he labeled it an accident. After the fire department reopened the investigation in 1993, they discovered many files had been destroyed because the fire had been labeled an accident. However, the few available documents further proved it was arson. Notably, the toxicology report showed high carbon monoxide levels in the children's bodies, indicating that an accelerant had been used. By 1994, Detective Ed Reynolds was convinced that Gene Keidel had started the deadly fire. But he had a problem. The arson investigation did not get him any closer to getting a warrant to dig up the backyard. So he continued to look for ways to look under cement without disturbing it. He called an FBI agent he knew, and the agent put him in contact with a Colorado-based nonprofit group, NecroSearch International. They help and train police agencies worldwide in locating, identifying, and excavating human remains. A geophysicist from the group, Clark Davenport, met with Detective Reynolds in September 1994. Davenport told him they would be able to use ground-penetrating radar. The radar would indicate if soil had been removed and put back in. Detective Reynolds then asked the owner of the home where the Keidels lived when Diane went missing if they could search using the radar, and they agreed. Davenport found an anomaly that was 6 feet long, 2 feet wide, and 2.5 feet deep in the spot where Lori said her mother was buried. Reynolds then went to get a search warrant. By this point, Lori was getting impatient. She decided she was going to buy the property and have her mother's remains unearthed. She called Detective Reynolds and told her what she planned to do. Reynolds asked her for 24 hours before she did anything, and Lori agreed. Detective Reynolds then got the warrant. Reynolds and his team broke out the cement and started digging where the anomaly had been found. Very quickly, they found a set of bones. Two nylon stockings were tied around the neck bones. Hours after the remains were found, Gene Keidel was arrested. He was 58 years old, and he was still living in Phoenix. Lori was able to bury her mother's remains next to the bodies of her two sisters. In early 1995, Lori and the firefighter who saved her, Ray Mullins, ended their romantic relationship. Gene Keidel went to trial in March 1995. The strongest evidence was Lori's testimony. She testified that she saw her father beat her mother and then bury her in the backyard. One problem was because of the state of the remains, DNA testing could not be done. That was a problem because Gene's lawyer could argue that it was not Diane's body. So an anthropologist used a process called photographic superimposition to identify the remains. This involves overlaying a photo of a victim when they were alive over their skull. Then she compared the position of the eye sockets, nasal passages, ear holes, and teeth. The anthropologist was 99% sure that the skull belonged to Diane. Also, a tree root from a neighbor's mulberry tree had grown through the skull. The root was sent to a dendrochronologist, an expert who can date the age of trees, at the University of Arizona. He concluded that the body was there before the tree was planted in 1978. The trial lasted 3 weeks. Then the jury deliberated for 3 days. They found Gene Keidel guilty of first-degree murder. In May 1995, he was sentenced to life in prison. That same month, Lori found out that the Maricopa County's medical examiner had changed the death certificate of her sisters. The cause of death was changed from accidental to arson. After the investigation was reopened in September 1993, three investigators from the fire department concluded it was an act of arson. Although it was now arson, it was decided that Jean wouldn't be charged with the murders of Susie and Kelly and the attempted murders of Lori and Greg. However, the district attorney told Lori if Jean had been acquitted of the murder of Diane or he was going to be released, he would have been charged. But since he was already sentenced to life in prison, they decided not to follow through with the charges. In the summer of 1995, Lori sued the city of Phoenix. She said that both the police and the fire departments were negligent in their investigations. As a result, her father stayed out of prison and she had to live with him. During that time, he abused her, one of his friends sexually abused her, and her brother and his friend sexually abused her. The city hired an out-of-state investigator to examine the evidence from the fire. The expert disagreed with the three experts from the Phoenix Fire Department and said that the fire had been accidental. He charged the city $50,000 for his work. In June 1998, Lori settled out of court with the city for $5.5 million. Jean Keidel died in custody at age 68 in December 2004. In 2023, Lori, who had remarried since the lawsuit and now had the last name Hodge, said that 55 years after the fire, she still had scars. Sometimes the scars crack and bleed. She called her father both wicked and evil. She believes that her father was held accountable for murdering his wife, daughter, and his stepdaughter in the afterlife.
This will conclude the episode. Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you hear, please leave a comment and subscribe. Thank you.